This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
So Tim Chester's written a book called You Can Change, and he helps us remember just how big God is when he opens up a particular chapter in this way. He says, traveling at the speed of light, which when you travel at the speed of light, you go 186,000 miles per second, okay? So 186,000 miles per second. Traveling at the speed of light, you would circle the earth 7 times in 1 second. And you would pass the moon in 2 seconds. And at this speed, it would take you 4.3 years to reach our nearest star and 100,000 years to cross our galaxy. There are thought to be at least 100 billion galaxies in the universe. And it would take 2 million light years to reach the next closest galaxy and 20 million light years to reach the next cluster of galaxies. And you've still only just begun to explore the universe. And all of this was made when God simply spoke a word. When he spoke a word, all that came into being. So, I mean, just consider that. Isn't that astounding? Last week, when we wrapped up the Psalms of Ascent, we were in Psalm 134, and we were encouraged to bless the Lord, and we were encouraged to receive blessing from the maker of heaven and earth, the one who spoke this into being, the one who made it. Many of us marvel and do indeed stand in awe of who God is. We know his greatness. We've tasted and seen that he's good and great and glorious and gracious. We know that there's no one like our God, right? Everyone in here knows that. Like if I said, gave a test on the way in, who's the most awesome person in the universe? Most of you coming into church would be like, yeah, it's God. He takes the deck. But there's a daily battle that takes place in our hearts and lives. The battle is within, it's within our hearts, and it's real. And it's especially seen in these days of pandemic, in these days of political maneuvering, and wondering who's really in control. And my hope as your pastor, I love you all. I want to give you a foundation so that when the Lord returns or calls you home, you'll be standing strong in him. If the Lord returned tomorrow, I don't want my last sermon to be, you better be really anxious about what's happening in November. Right? I want my last sermon to be, fix your eyes on Jesus and have hope right in the here and now. I want him to find you standing strong in him. I don't want your final breath before eternity to be, to the best that I can control, anxiety or acting as if the government isn't upon his shoulders, on the shoulders of the one we call Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. But here's the dilemma. We struggle to embrace God's rule and his reign in our lives. And even deeper, we fight. We don't trust. We often fight to trust that his reign is wise and good. We would never dare admit out loud that God isn't in control. But often we choose to live and believe that, and it's a lie. The essence of straying from God in Romans 1 is exchanging the truth of God for a lie. And when we go down the road of not making God our trust and our treasure to allowing our hearts to trust and to treasure some lesser thing, then we're drifting into unbelief. We've exchanged the truth of God for a lie. And so today, I'm wanting, just in this sermon, this one-off sermon on Labor Day weekend, I'm wanting God to cement and deepen our love and trust and worship of himself. He is both praiseworthy and worthy to be praised. Again, Chester's so masterful when he writes, our problems rarely arise from a lack of belief in a confessional or theoretical sense, though this may be the case. More often, they arise from functional or practical disbelief. There's a gap between what we believe in theory and what we believe in practice. And that gap is called, the narrowing of that gap is called sanctification. Like when we believe something to be true on paper, but it's not yet true in our lives. as we come to make it more true in our lives, that's what we call sanctification or growing in godliness. Sanctification is the progressive narrowing of the gap between confessional faith and functional faith. In other words, your growth in your trust of God will happen as you can take truth that you believe on paper about God and let that wield a strong influence in your life and how you live and think and act in the here and now. Jesus said we would know the truth and the truth would set us free. Like it would like enable us to really live. You want true freedom, it's found in Jesus. And Jesus didn't intend that growing would cause us to escape our dependence on God. No, the reality is that the more we know about God, who he is and what he's done for us, we will be affected and plunged into action. We will be freed up to actually live. Knowing God can free us from the shackles of unbelief that tighten around us. And knowing more of him frees us to trust in him and to walk with him in life. So today we come to Psalm 145. And I'm wanting to take truth about God and flesh it out in how we live. And there's all kinds of actions at play in this. God's attributes readily affect the way you and I live. So I want us to come out of my goal is at the end of the sermon, which I know I've kind of chosen a song for the end of the service that says, Lord, you're all I need. But I'm wanting the cry of your heart at the end of this sermon to be, God, I have everything I need in you. C.S. Lewis said that the moment you wake up each morning, all your wishes and hopes for the day rush at you like wild animals. And the first job of each morning consists in shoving them all back and in listening to that other voice, taking that other point of view, letting that other, larger, stronger, quieter life come flowing in. God's going to show us all kinds of truth about himself in this passage today. And the question is it going to move us? Will that other, larger, stronger, quieter life flow in and have an influence in our lives today? So I'm fighting for us to trust in the God who's revealed himself in the Bible with all of our hearts. Now, if you're an unbeliever here today, I want you to see the God of the Bible in this message. He is more satisfying and he offers more hope than anything in this life. Seeing him frees us. We think we're going through life with like a kung fu grip on life, that we have this under control and we're making decisions and we have determination and we're able to choose this way and determine our own destiny and dig deep within ourselves. And I'm saying you can't really do that if you're honest. You can't. You need the help of another. You can't really change anyone, let alone yourself, but God can. And so will you turn from yourself to him? God's character's put on display ultimately in this good news that God sent his son to rescue people like us. So today I hope you put your trust in him. And if you're a believer, there's hope for us today too. God is praiseworthy and worthy to be praised. And I want you to be moved. I want you to think about God and see that there is no one in this world that compares to him. In fact, I hope by the end of this sermon, you'll have more confidence that he is indeed Emmanuel, God with us in these days. See, coronavirus and political stuff, going back to school, all the questions that come with all that stuff may cause us to doubt if God's really with us, may cause us to doubt whether or not he really is Emmanuel. But he is, and he's going to show us that in this passage. And I believe as you see this, you'll be free, be set free from the constraints of this world to lean into him with all your life. So join me today as we see three ways that action is provoked in us because of our God. And Psalm 145. So follow along with me as I read Psalm 145. A song of praise of David. I will extol you, my God and King, and bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you and praise your name forever and ever. Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall commend your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts. On the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works I will meditate. They shall speak of the might of your awesome deeds, and I will declare your greatness. They shall pour forth the fame of your abundant goodness and shall sing aloud of your righteousness. The Lord is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. The Lord is good to all, and his mercy is over all that he's made. All your works shall give thanks to you, O Lord, and all your saints shall bless you. They shall speak of the glory of your kingdom and tell of your power, to make known to the children of man your mighty deeds and the glorious splendor of your kingdom. Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures throughout all generations. The Lord is faithful in all his words and kind in all of his works. The Lord upholds all who are falling and raises up all who are bowed down. The eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food in due season. You open your hand, you satisfy the desire of every living thing. The Lord is righteous in all of his ways and kind in all his works. The Lord is near to all who call on him, to all who call on him in truth. He fulfills the desire of those who fear him. He also hears their cry and saves them. The Lord preserves all who love him, but all the wicked he will destroy. My mouth will speak the praise of the Lord, and let all flesh bless his holy name forever and ever. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So, three ways that action is provoked in us because of our God in Psalm 145. And the first way that action is provoked in us is because we see God's character, and that provokes praise. God's character provokes praise. Look with me beginning in verse 3. In the middle of verse 3, we see that God is greatly to be praised. And in verses 3 through 9, we get some of the reasons why he's greatly to be praised. It's not just like, you know, God should be praised. It's like he should be greatly praised. Greatly is the modifier there. He's greatly to be praised. And what are some of the reasons why? Well, he's great. He's great. Great is the Lord. His greatness is unsearchable. We can't reach the end of God's greatness so that we have him pegged. We can't think, well, I finally understand how great God is. No, it's unsearchable. You can't reach the end of it. Generations commend his works to another and declare how mighty they are. Generation after generation extols the virtues of how he's greatly to be praised and how he's great, and there's no one like him. Imagine how the people of God have consistently rehearsed what God has done. He's great. He's great. Another reason why, verse 5 speaks of how he's gloriously majestic. David says that as he considers the glorious splendor of God's majesty and all the wondrous works he's done, he has to stop. He has to pause and meditate and consider these things. He needs to marinate and dwell on these things. And verse 6 says that as others speak of the might of God's awesome deeds, David has to admit what in verse 6? God is great. In verse 7, we see that God's good. God has a fame that speaks of abundant goodness. That's what his reputation is. Even lost people in the world know this, that God has a reputation for being good. Verse 9 says that he's good to all. Whether someone denies his existence or bows in worship to him right now, God treats everyone way better than they deserve. He gives life and breath to every living thing. He's good. And at the end of verse 7, David sings aloud that God's righteous. So a lot of people in our world right now are looking for justice or righteousness, that who's going to make this right? Who's going to avenge the wrongs? Well, here's the Bible's answer. God is. He's the one who's righteous. God's the one you're looking for if you're looking for righteousness or justice, because God's the one whose very character is righteous. This is who he is. It's at the core of who he is. And then we also see that he's gracious and merciful. He's slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. His mercy, verse 9, is over all that he's made. I mean, isn't this an amazing character resume? Doesn't this draw you out? Can you really read these verses and hear this description I just gave and say, yep, that's pretty impressive? I mean, doesn't it have to provoke you? Doesn't it have to move you? Doesn't it have to draw you out? Can you really read of these things like a boring resume and think, yeah, that's pretty sweet. You know, that's, he's got a lot going for him. No, God is unlike anyone anywhere, and this should provoke praise. his greatness, his majestic glory, his goodness, his righteousness, his being gracious provoke our consideration. They provoke our song. They provoke our praise. It leads us to action. We have to do something with that. We can't just sit idly by and say, yeah, he's the greatest. No, we have to, we're provoked to praise. So that's verses 3 to 9. In verses 10 to 20, we move from character qualities to his works, and we see how God's works provoke blessing. God's works provoke blessing. So his character provokes praise, his works provoke blessing. And that's what verse 10 invites us to do. Look at verse 10. All your works shall give thanks to you, O Lord, and all your saints shall bless you. Like all of God's people will bless him for this, for his works. And then he spells out some of the works. So let's just walk through this again. In verse 11, we see that God rules. Verse 11 tells us that of the glory of his kingdom and of his power, children know his mighty deeds and can see the glorious splendor of his kingdom. God's rule is more than some like temporary win of the day. No, verse 13 tells us that his kingdom is everlasting and his dominion endures throughout all generations, that he's faithful in all his words and kind in all his works. His rule is the type of thing that's devoted to his people, and it's good. That's the verdict on it. Like, his rule is exemplary. Like, his approval rating is off the charts because of how he rules. It's for the good of his people. It's characterized by mercy. He rules. And look at that. His kingdom is everlasting. Do you think that includes today? Do you think that his kingdom is, if it's everlasting and it endures forever, do you think that there's a moment where that doesn't happen? You think like coronavirus just slipped under the mat here somehow and God's like not in control of that? No, he's got a kingdom that endures forever. He also sustains by upholding all who are falling and raising up those who are bowed down. I mean, look at the description there. Upholding those who are falling and raising up those who are bowed down. You may feel like you're hanging on by a thread, but God's got the thread and he's got you. You're not going to like fall from him. Like, he's going to sustain you. You may be brought low and wonder who can help. And the answer is God can. He loves to sustain people in the midst of these circumstances. So as we've been overwhelmed this year, I hope you've fallen into that he is sustaining us as his people. He supplies. God's not stingy with his stuff. He's got open hands that satisfy the desires of living things. He's righteous and kind in all of his ways. So verse 17 helps unpack verse 16. You might think, well, I'm a living thing. Why doesn't God give me all of my desires? Well, because of verse 17, right? The Lord is righteous in all of his ways and kind in all of his works. But God's not governed like by your whims and desires. He's governed by his righteousness and kindness, doing what's best for you, doing what is ultimately kind to you, doing what's ultimately righteous for you. If God gave you all your desires, you're the God of the universe, not him. Right? So he's righteous and he's kind in all of his ways. Verse 17 says, because the reason God doesn't give us all of our desires is because Father knows best. He's the one who's just and good. He supplies us what's appropriate in the moment. Verses 18 and 19, he answers prayer. Like in the previous verses, when those who call on him in truth, they experience his nearness. He fulfills the desires of those who fear him. So again, he doesn't just fulfill the desires willy-nilly, it's those who fear him that he fulfills the desires of. It's a reverence for him that he calls the shots, that he has the final, his will be done. So some of your desires just might not line up with the fear of him. Reverencing God puts us in a position to ask for what would be best. And God's ear is bent to those who are crying out for help, and he saves them. He answers prayer. He preserves those who love him. Verse 20, he preserves those who love him. Isn't that encouraging? that you may think, well, I love God, man, I just feel like I'm just barely hanging on. When you love God, he never gives up on you. And with this comfort for those who love him, we get the news that his justice demands at the end of verse 20 that he destroys the wicked. So isn't that an amazing verse? Verse 20, the Lord preserves all he loves, all those who love him. So he's caring for his people. He's devoted to them. And what about the wicked? But all the wicked he will destroy. He will weed out right and wrong and distribute justice perfectly in the end. So, man, aren't God's actions incredible? I mean, we just blaze through those verses and you might just think, man, there's a lot going on there. Well, for sure. But his actions are incredible. It's almost like he's God or something, right? I mean, who else can act this way? Not only does he have a character that provokes praise, but he does things. He works in such a way that it provokes blessing. Or like we defined it last week, gratefully reviewing all that he is and does in worship. That's what blessing is. Gratefully reviewing all that he is and all that he does in worship. So are you getting a sense for who should loom large in your life in these days? Are you getting a sense of what should loom large in your life in these days if you're the people of God? Well, there's one more piece. One final action that's provoked here. And it's God's timelessness provokes eternal stirring. God's timelessness provokes eternal stirring. And you might have heard this refrain at the beginning and the end, and I draw it out this way because really verses 1 and 2 and verse 21 are kind of getting at the same truth. So, because I think a lot of us think, yeah, man, in the good times, I need to be praising God more. Or you might think, like, in the bad times, I need to be, like, leaning into him for sure. What if I told you that God's character and works were related to eternal realities? So it's not about the good times or the bad. This is always the right moment to be giving him praise. Or like verse 1 says, to extol him. Right out of the gate, verse 1 says, come, invites us to come. I will extol you, my God and King. So like just extolling him. Like showing that he's more virtuous, he's more praiseworthy than anyone else. And we bless his name forever and ever. There's the bless again at the end of verse 1. So do you think that right now we're exempt from blessing him if it's to be forever and ever? Or does forever and ever mean something more? That like there's never a moment where it's not appropriate to extol and to bless him? Or listen to verse 2. It's even made more emphatic, right? Look at what does verse 2 say? I mean, this is incredible. Every day, I will bless you and praise your name forever and ever. I mean, is he really repeating this for us again? Doesn't he know that we know what forever and ever means? I think the psalmist is saying, like, no, you need a reminder. Like, every day, you should be blessing him and extolling him. God is not overdoing it. He's saying we need this driven into our heads. More than you need cable news, you need to wake up every day and be thinking and extolling and blessing God. That is the need of the day. It's forever and ever. And in verse 21, the psalm ends. It comes full circle to us, right? With our mouths. In verse 21, my mouth will speak the praise of the Lord. Speak it. Have you done that over the last 6 months? Have you spoken the praise of the Lord? Have you just in the moment said, Lord, I praise you. Praise you. You're not out of control. You are in control. You got this. What about in the last week? Some of you might have had a whale of a week. I know I did. So isn't this kind of speaking the praise of the Lord? Isn't this the natural response of someone who knows a God with this kind of character and works? We put words together that make much of him. And it's not just us. Look at David. Like, it's like a bomb goes off, and look at how that spreads to everyone. In verse 21, my mouth will speak the praise of the Lord, and let all flesh bless his name Bless his holy name forever and ever. Every person you meet in Hutch, every person reading your post on Facebook, every person watching your snaps on Snapchat or your TikToks, all flesh is invited to bless his holy name. And we're to do this forever and ever. It's never ending. Just like the psalm began, it ends with this reminder. Every single moment of your life is an opportunity to bless God, rehearsing his character and works in worship. So are you getting the psalm? So we have God's character being praised. We have God's works being blessed. And we have this happening forever and ever and ever and ever. This psalm is the last acrostic poem in the Hebrew Bible, like in the Psalter. Do you know what an acrostic poem is? It's like where I would take the first letters of my name and write, you know, P is like punctuality, H is hungry, I is icy, L is full of life or something, you know, just. And so this is what's going on in this chapter. Every verse, you could take the Hebrew alphabet and write Aleph to Tet, you know, straight all the way down, and then there's a verse extolling God's praise. Basically, every letter of the Hebrew alphabet is being used to stir us up to praise. Or as Derek Kidner called this psalm, he called it an alphabet of praise. God is praiseworthy and to be praised. So in conclusion today, we've seen three ways that action is provoked in us because of our God. That God's character provokes praise, his works provoke blessing, and his timelessness provokes an eternal stirring of these things. Now, on one level, I think there's some of us in this room who just need to trust. We're much too anxious about so many aspects of life. So whether it's COVID, whether it's who might win the presidential election in November, what might happen in schools this fall, or any other number of issues. This psalm is really throwing down and picking a fight with you and saying, God has all of this. Do you trust him? God has all of this. Do you trust him? Now, this isn't a call for recklessness. It's not a call to not use the best information available to us to be wise in the present moment. But it's a call to orient our hearts heavenward now and forever. Will we trust God? That is the question. Are we going to go all in with him? Like, are we just going to sit and theoretically say, well, yeah, God's all those things? No, is the gap going to shrink? Does God being all those things, is that going to have an impact in how I live tomorrow morning? Is it going to shrink? Is the theoretical going to come to the practical? Like how I live. So, one way that I'm reminded to trust God is to remember the four G's, which naturally flow out of this passage. The four G's are four truths about God that stabilize us in life. That God is great, God is glorious, God is good, and God is gracious. So, we've seen all those in this passage, right? So I'm not like laying something on the text. If you look through verses 3 through 9, we have great, good, glorious, and gracious. All those things are there. So, God has shown us these things that we might change and not walk as we once did. There's four statements that flow out of these characteristics about God that are a great diagnostic tool for our own hearts. So consider the first G, God is great. So I don't have to be in control. That's the first one. God is great, so I don't have to be in control. And man, have we had some control issues over the last 6 months, right? We wonder if God has lost control. I mean, that comes to play like in the mask issue, whether they should be mandatory or how we think of others not wearing masks. God is great, so I don't have to ultimately be in control of that. He's the great one. He will ultimately control the election this fall. He will put whoever needs to be in office in office. You may have strong opinions about who that needs to be. You may even try to be controlling that. God's the one who's in control. You don't have to be. You can be freed up just to trust him and vote, right? So you should vote. But God's the one person in the world who knows what's up with the coronavirus. I mean, information's changed the more it goes, the more we learn. God's the one person who knows. We can trust him. We don't have to be in control. He's great. We are freed from being in control. So that's the question. Am I going to choose God's control or mine? Am I going to rest in his greatness? So that's the first G. God is great, so I don't have to be in control. Secondly, God is glorious, so I don't have to fear others. Proverbs tells us that fearing others is a snare. And when we fear others, it's closely connected to the idea that we've lost the fear of God. We forgot how glorious he is. And so as we've seen his glory today, we're set free. That I don't have to fear others that might invade my personal space. I don't have to fear getting sick. I don't have to fear the government's actions. I don't have to fear losing my freedoms. Because God's the one who's glorious. Fearing him frees me to serve others with love. I'm freed because he's glorious. He's the one I ultimately fear. Okay? I'm not going to fear things in this world. I'm going to fear him. I don't have to fear others. He's glorious. Or God's good, so I don't have to look elsewhere for my satisfaction. Joy drives a lot of what we do in life. And we know that eternal joy is found in God, but we sure do search for joy in the stuff of this world. And so because God is good, I don't have to find joy or satisfaction in getting my person elected in November. God's good. I don't have to find my satisfaction there. I don't have to find my joy or satisfaction in the government responding rightly to this crisis or in pursuing my health and being anxious about it. God's good. I'm freed from being paralyzed to think that if only, because my satisfaction and joy is in a good God who satisfies all my wants and desires and gives me true joy. If I believe that about him, I'm set free from like holding tightly to all these things. Or God's gracious, so I don't have to prove myself. And we try to justify ourselves by getting caught up into arguments and working for vindication. We're trying to prove to others that we're right and they're wrong. And this can consume us. We can be consumed with a desire that wants to be right. But we know, because God is gracious, we can't make ourselves right in his sight. We can't clean ourselves up enough. We can't do it. God alone is the one whose character is gracious and comes after sinners, so we can relax. We don't have to do X, Y, or Z to impress God. We don't have to show others that we have it all figured out and we have special information that no one knows so that we can be right and they can be wrong. We don't have to show them that. Even if others disagree with us, we don't have to post something that proves that we're better than they are. If I think I'm right, I don't have to prove myself to anyone because God's the gracious one. We might tend to think that we have to work or get things just right to be impressive to him, but that works against grace. I mean, we don't understand what grace is. If you have to work to be impressive to God, then it's a works righteousness. It's you getting everything right and God's impressed with that. And that's not what grace is. Grace is the fact that God's impressed with himself. And he just lavishes that on people that don't deserve it all the time. So because God is gracious, I don't have to prove myself. We're freed to rest in him. All these things. So today, are we going to continue in the frustrations of this life by seeking to exercise our control, by fearing others and what they can do, by finding joy in being better than others, or even trying to prove ourselves as being right? Are we just going to find the freedom that comes as we trust in our great, glorious, good, and gracious God? Are we going to trust him? He's the one who's praiseworthy and to be praised. So let's settle on him that we might be a people who glorify and enjoy him forever.